down to the wire in Switzerland. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. High stakes in Lausanne, Switzerland, as tomorrow's deadline for a nuclear deal with Iran looms, and negotiators still have work to do.
It's a lot of different pieces to put together and keep everybody on board with at the same time.
Sounds like showtime for the diplomats, but for the journalists covering the talks...
Frankly, you know, people are kind of bored. Like, people are kind of just waiting. It's like watching paint dry.
Plus, South African comedian Trevor Noah gets a big break. He'll take over for Jon Stewart as host of The Daily Show.
He is the perfect person to take that gauntlet from Jon Stewart because he's very smart and he's very sharp and he's going to make you uncomfortable.
Those stories ahead right here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It looks like those nuclear talks with Iran will be coming down to the wire. You could even feel that here in Boston today. The president and vice president were here for a ceremony honoring the late Edward Kennedy, and the skies were abuzz this morning with helicopter shuttles. But Secretary of State John Kerry, a former Massachusetts senator himself, was not in any of them. That's how crucial his presence is in Switzerland for the Iran talks, before all parties hit the agreement deadline tomorrow. Kerry's Iranian counterpart has thrown in some last-minute changes, and in a few minutes we'll hear more about what it's like to negotiate these issues with Iran. But first, for the latest, I turn to my BBC colleague Barbara Plett in Switzerland.
The negotiators have been hard at it all day. The day started with a meeting of all the foreign ministers. So that's the foreign ministers of the six global powers that are negotiating with Iran, including Secretary Kerry, also Britain, France, Russia, China, and Germany. That meeting, an Iranian negotiator said, was very serious. It was very detailed. He said a lot of the times these kinds of meetings were general, but this one was not. And then afterwards, they went to negotiators at the political director level and the technical level. And we're hearing that those negotiations are very tough. A number of outstanding issues still to be solved, and it doesn't seem like either side has moved on them. The core of this agreement is to try to limit Iran's ability to enrich uranium and to monitor its nuclear program very closely so that it wouldn't be able to break out and produce enough fuel for a bomb in less than a year. But the difficult issues, it seems, are not so much related to enrichment production as to other things.
And do you know what those other things are?
Well, one of the key ones is Iran's demand that it is allowed to continue with nuclear research and development. It has been experimenting with advanced centrifuges. These are the machines that spin uranium and eventually make it into nuclear fuel. And our understanding is that the agreement that they're working on looks at a 10-year limit. And then there's a period beyond that, which one U.S. official called the 11 to 15-year phase, where it's unclear how many of those restrictions would still stick with Iran. And it's insisting that after 10 years, it should be allowed to continue with its research, because otherwise it's going to be completely outdated and have to rely on foreign technology and that sort of thing. This seems to be quite a sticking point. Another major sticking point is the issue of sanctions. Of course, the trade-off of the deal is that Iran limits its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions being lifted. It would like all of them lifted as quickly as possible. That includes economic sanctions levied by the U.S. and the Europeans, as well as sanctions from the U.N., which are aimed at its nuclear program, preventing it from getting nuclear technology. And it wants those UN sanctions lifted as well. The other powers that are negotiating with it want a much more gradual lifting of sanctions tied to steps taken by Iran to limit its program. And they say that the UN ones in particular, because they are so directly related to nuclear technology, would probably be among the last to go. So that's another major sticking point.
Barbara, have you been able to take any pulse of the atmosphere? Is it tense or jovial? What's going on?
I don't think it's jovial. I think it's tense, maybe not. It's very focused. The negotiators are focusing very closely on what is quite difficult discussions. They have political dimensions, of course, but there's also very, very technical details and the top nuclear scientists in both countries are involved in them as well. So we have different assessments of how optimistic people are. They started out reasonably optimistic. We've got a quote from a Chinese diplomat today saying that's turning to gloom. But it's difficult to know really at this stage how much of this is brinkmanship and how much of it really is that neither side has more space to move. I think that will become clearer on Tuesday.
The BBC's Barbara Plett there at the talks in Lausanne, Switzerland. Now, while the stumbling blocks to a deal with Tehran still loom large, Matthew Bunn, who leads Harvard's Managing the Atom Project, thinks they can be overcome. And he says the flawed pact that's starting to emerge looks better than no agreement at all.
Will it have as tight constraints on Iranian capabilities as I would like? Of course not. Will it have as far-reaching inspections as I would prefer? Of course not, because it is a compromise. But if you look at the potential alternatives, which really are returning to sanctions while Iran builds up its nuclear capabilities rather than cutting them back under the deal, and then potentially being faced with either military strikes or acquiescing as they move toward nuclear weapons, this deal looks a lot better than those plausible alternatives.
Matthew, you've been involved in closed-door talks before, right?
Yes.
So tell us how the vantage point of the people sitting around the table is just different from everybody watching back here at home or even down in the bar at the Beau Rivage Hotel in Lausanne.
When you're sitting across the table from someone over a period of weeks or months, you end up understanding better than the people back in your capital do what the other side needs and why, and the justification for certain compromises that are being made. So the really difficult part of many of these negotiations is that sort of tension between the negotiator on the ground, who has been sort of socialized into understanding what the other side needs as a bottom line, and the people back home who haven't. My father was one of the key negotiators of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty decades ago, the treaty that sets the whole framework for preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. And that similarly was a very complex negotiation where there was sort of a bilateral set of talks between the Soviet Union and the United States, but then the United States had to keep its allies on board, the Soviet Union had to keep its allies on board, the U.S. government had to keep the Congress, the other parts of the U.S. government, like the Joint Chiefs of Staff and so on board. And it ends up being this very complex multi-level game.
Is there something particular, maybe you know, in the Iranian negotiating style that the Americans constantly have to work around?
Well, the Iranians are famous for their skill at the sort of negotiations that you would have in a bazaar. If you've ever shopped in a bazaar in the Middle East, you know that you go back and forth on price and the seller is just being completely unreasonable and you have to actually be willing to walk away
right
before the seller will then compromise.
You're saying that comes into the room on nuclear negotiations?
Absolutely. The Iranians for months have been not compromising as much as the U.S. side wanted, for years really. And now finally at the last minute, the compromises are coming to some extent on both sides. Now, my involvement has mostly been sort of advising and then talking to the Iranians in a non-government capacity. A decade ago, a retired Iranian deputy foreign minister and I actually put together compromise proposals that we published that both he and I were willing to sign on to. Unfortunately, at that time, those proposals were not accepted by the two governments. And at that time, the Iranians had only a few hundred centrifuges. Mm. If we had managed to freeze them there, we would be in a much better position than we are today. But at that time, the U.S. side was unwilling to accept the idea that there would be any centrifuges at all in Iran. Now we're talking about how many thousands there are going to be.
Haggling is a lot of fun when you're buying a carpet or tomatoes, but I can't imagine it's going to be much fun if the U.S. plus five just say, no, we're walking away.
No, it's not going to be a lot of fun. And in particular, one of my big concerns right now is Congress is considering legislation that could mess up the deal. And if the world perceives that the reason there wasn't a deal is because the United States and its Congress walked away, then it will be very difficult to sustain let alone strengthen the sanctions regime, because countries like China and India will return to buying Iranian oil. Russia will implement the deal it's already cut in principle with the Iranians to essentially launder Iranian oil through Russia, and will be left with Iran building up and fewer sanctions that are really effective in place than we have today. So I think this deal is the best alternative we've got going. If anybody's going to walk away, it should be the Iranians and not us.
Matthew Bunn leads the Managing the Atom Project at Harvard's Belfer Center. Matthew, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, as we wait for fresh news out of those nuclear talks in Lausanne, all the journalists covering the talks have to cool their heels in the swanky halls of the Beau Rivage Palace. That's a 19th century hotel overlooking Lake Geneva where the diplomats are trying to hash things out. Rosie Gray is one of those journalists who staked out a spot in the hotel lobby. She's been reporting for BuzzFeed on what's going on the sidelines of the nuclear talks.
The hotel bar, which is where I'm at right now, is where kind of everybody sort of congregates. As for the actual action of the negotiations, that's happening in rooms upstairs that we're not really allowed in. So people are just kind of mingling around, you know, gossiping, trying to figure out what they can.
Yeah, and in that bar at the Beau Rivage at night, is it just one big scrounge fest with everybody trying to get any little bit of information they can from whoever?
Yeah, and people just kind of drinking, you know what I mean,
right.
And just hanging out.
I mean,
it's a big waiting game. The officials who are here could say something one day, and then the next day it turns out that they're saying a completely opposite thing. So, you know, it's very incremental, and it's very hard to get a handle on what actually is going on.
What's interesting that you point out in your story for BuzzFeed is it's not just media there. You've got representatives from the National Iranian American Council, the NIAC, that's a U.S.-based group, and more recently, representatives from the Israel Project have shown up. What do these two groups represent, and what are they trying to do with the media? Are they talking to the press?
Well, NIAC is a group that advocates greater engagement with Iran. They're big fans of this diplomacy that's happening right now. And the Israel Project is a group, sort of like a pro-Israel advocacy organization based in D.C. The NIAC guys have been coming actually for a while, for about a year and a half. But recently, the Israel Project guys started coming as well. And it's created, I mean, the term I used sort of as a joke was proxy war. But they're basically sort of battling for influence on the sidelines in terms of influencing the coverage.
And what does that actually mean, trying to influence the coverage?
In the case of these two groups, and neither of these groups are actually connected to any government.
Right.
But they're sort of trying to fill in the gaps. Like I said, because the actual information leaks out so slowly, there's room for people to come in and kind of try to fill the gaps for reporters. They're all sort of spending their days, you know, talking to reporters, doing interviews, etc.
Right. So their quotes and opinions are getting out. Whether it's actually having an effect on the talks is a completely different question.
Yeah, I think that's a separate issue, really.
So the media there have been giving big treatments to sidebars, like the Chinese foreign minister has gone out for a run along the lake. In the absence of any concrete news out of the negotiation room, is that where things are kind of at?
That was a big one today. He was wearing the tracksuit. People were commenting on that. I mean, you know, like when John Kerry was going out for bike rides and that kind of thing. I do think that when you're in this sort of waiting period, the little stuff, people focus a little bit more on that. Because honestly, I think, frankly, you know, people are kind of bored. It's like watching paint dry. And any little piece of entertainment can be, you know, useful and fun for Twitter.
Just taking a micropulse on the progress of these talks. So the fact that John Kerry is there and not here in Massachusetts today to honor Edward Kennedy. I mean, that must be a sign that we are close to something, big or small.
Signs seem to point that tomorrow this thing is going to be wrapped up in one way or another. A bunch of the foreign ministers that said that they were going to leave today ended up staying, except for Lavrov. He is leaving, but apparently is coming back tomorrow.
The Russian foreign
minister. The Russian foreign minister. So that could be an indication that they're getting close and they're all canceling other things in order to just like really push to the end, or not, because things could change at the last second.
Rosie, I got to say, I've been following tweets from journalists from these talks for a while now. It seems like this is kind of a cushy gig for reporters. They've been staying in nice Swiss hotels, eating pretty nice food, but basically hanging out with very little to quote and just waiting for that one big byline that they can write up. Am I wrong about that?
I think that's basically right. I do think that a lot of people are here because news organizations have the attitude of somebody has to be there. Like, we have to be there.
Well, there are a couple of good places for croque monsieur in Lausanne, I got to say.
I had one yesterday, so.
Rosie Gray, reporting for BuzzFeed from the Iranian nuclear talks in Lausanne, Switzerland. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
You remember the Flying Nun? Stick around. We got the singing priest in just a few. And yes, he really can sing on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you are tuned to The World. Jon Stewart out, that's old news. Trevor Noah in, that's the news today from Comedy Central. And huge news for South Africa. Trevor Noah is a Johannesburg native, his mom South African and black, his dad Swiss and white. He's already been doing reports for The Daily Show, and now he's been chosen to take over Jon Stewart's desk. He'll be filling big shoes, but Noah's dealt with harder things in his life, like growing up mixed race in apartheid South Africa. It's been part of his stand-up routine for a while, as in this appearance at the Apollo, where he remembered what it was like taking a walk with his mom.
My mom could walk with me. My mom could walk with me. But if the police showed up, she'd have to let go of my hand and drop me and act like I wasn't hers every single time, because we weren't supposed to exist as a family. So my mom would let go. It was like a little game we played. Police would show up like, woo! She'd be like, woo! I don't know. I don't know. No, it's not mine. It's not mine. Oh, no, I don't know. It was horrible for me. I felt like a bag of weed. It was a tough time.
You can see why Trevor Noah is a huge star in South Africa. Pearl Boshamani gets it. She's the editor of a Daily Planet essay. How do South Africans feel about one of their own heading to America to take over really a great gig for Jon Stewart?
Everyone's incredibly excited because initially when the rumors came out over the weekend, a lot of us were cautiously optimistic. It was like, okay, this would be so great if Trevor could get it. But to be honest, I personally did not think that Comedy Central, I didn't believe in them enough.
Why is that?
You know, because I didn't think that they'd go for, you know, a mixed race foreigner who'd only been on the show like three times to actually take that really, really big seat that I think quite a few people in the States wanted. But then when the news came out, it was incredibly huge and exciting. A lot of people say that they're going to have parties and pop champagne for Trevor. And I actually saw a tweet earlier, which sums up, I think, how it is that Trevor Noah has temporarily reunited South Africa.
Right. Reunited because he is so important to all South Africans, black or white, or because he himself is mixed race?
It's because he's important to South Africans, black and white. And that's what's made Trevor so huge locally. He's not just like, you know, the comedian that white people like or the comedian that black people like. Because he is a mix of both, he's always been able to sort of bridge the two worlds because there really are still two worlds in South Africa. And he understands both sides. He's lived both lives, it's fair to say. And so black people can relate to him and white people can relate to him.
So the Daily Show host, that's a huge gig. It's a big chair. You could argue, and a lot of people have, that it's more important to young generations than the anchor chair on actual primetime news. So given what you know about Trevor Noah, what do you think's in store for us here in the U.S. with this switch?
I think you're in store for, first of all, he is the perfect person to take that gauntlet from Jon Stewart because he's very smart and he's very sharp and he's going to make you uncomfortable. And I feel like Jon Stewart did that a lot too, does it really, really well. And because he's a foreigner, it'll be very interesting to get his take on many things that I suppose somebody who is an American wouldn't see the way that he sees them. He's very observational. He's so smart. He's so funny. You laugh at his jokes, but you're also going to cringe at the same time. That's what you can look forward to. And I think you can also look forward to maybe, hopefully, I hope, more stuff like Spot the Africa, where he's out here trying to, you know, change perceptions about other parts of the world.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, because one of his jokes is that he was born a crime, as in the joke we heard from the Apollo, that he actually could not exist in apartheid South Africa. So how much has he not just pushed conversations about race and apartheid with his comedy, but actually been changing attitudes and even, I don't know, policy?
You know, policy, probably not much. Attitudes, a fair amount. I think maybe one of the comedians has helped us laugh at ourselves a little bit more than we did before. And especially about race issues, because Trevor's always really been so tactful and graceful just between, you know, the two worlds where he'll offend one person and then he'll offend the next. But then at the end of the day, it's like, okay, it's cool. He kind of, excuse my language, he shat on everyone equally.
So a reporter I know in South Africa today tweeted, everyone I talk to is happy for Trevor Noah, but when I listen carefully, they are happy for Africa. Finally, we are recognized for excellence. Do you think that's also part of why this is important for South Africans?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's like, and you've probably heard this before, but it's probably like a Barack Obama moment when he became president. It was, first of all, a lot of black people were excited, but then also Kenyans were excited, even though he technically is not Kenyan. He is American. Mm. But people got on that because it's always nice to get, even though we act like we don't want it, but it's always nice to get a bit of validation, especially internationally. And it's going to be great to have someone flying the flag because we've got Charlize Theron, but it's just going to be absolutely fantastic now to have the comedian doing it too.
So, Pearl, what do you like about Trevor's humor?
I like how biting it is. I don't always obviously like all of his jokes. Sometimes I wouldn't say get offended, but I feel myself sort of cringing definitely over some of the things he says. And I like that. He pushes the boundaries more than a lot of local comedians have, but in a way that's still where you still like want to have a drink with him. You know, some comedians will push the boundaries and you want to punch them. I've never had that moment with him. And that's what I like about him. He's good natured. He's fun. And he's smart. And look at him now, Daily Show host. Woo!
Look at him now. Pearl, great to speak with you. Pearl Boshamane, editor at Daily Planet SA. Thank you.
Thank you.
So the Daily Show is not ending, just moving on to another very talented host. Here's another reason to be joyful today. That melody you may recognize, it's Leonard Cohen's well-known tune, Hallelujah. But the words are different. They were changed for a wedding, specifically the wedding of Chris and Leah O'Kane. They got married about a year ago at a church in Oldcastle, Ireland. The couple knew they were going to be married by Father Ray Kelly, who presides at St. Bridget's Catholic Church in Oldcastle. What they didn't know is that Father Ray was actually going to sing to them during the Mass. And little did Father Ray know the excitement his unique gift would generate.
Emails, YouTube, phone calls, you name it. After it went up on YouTube, there was a request for to fly me out to South Africa, fly me to, you know, all over the States, fly me to Poland, Croatia, all over the place. People just wanted me to, they would bring me out to perform the wedding. And sometimes it wasn't even to perform a wedding, but just to sing Hallelujah.
As that YouTube recording can attest, Father Ray has a great voice. But the Catholic priest freely admits he can't take all the credit. He says he first heard those new wedding lyrics for Hallelujah at another wedding he officiated 7 or 8 years ago.
While I was finished the service and we were signing the civil register and whatever, this little girl, she was a bridesmaid as well, she was about 10, and she started singing Leonard Cohen's song Hallelujah with the words changed to suit the bride and groom with their names and to suit a wedding. And at the end of the service then and signing of the register, I went over to her and I says, God, I'd love a copy of the words of that, you know. And she gave me a copy of the words, and as I found out afterwards, she actually wrote the words herself for that particular wedding with the help of her mum and dad.
So a 10-year-old girl and Leonard Cohen helped launch Father Ray Kelly's singing career. That's right, a career, because a 61-year-old has actually signed with a major U.S. record label. And he's just released his debut CD, which includes a studio version of the reworked Hallelujah. Father Ray thinks he's just riding the coattails of Leonard Cohen's original song.
I think it's the music is the tune itself, you know. I think it's the music that gets to people straight away, first of all, more so than the words.
Still, Father Ray Kelly says he's going to keep doing what he calls the two best jobs in the world. And in a way, is there really that big a difference between preaching and singing?
With the priest and the family.
And yes, of course you can see that viral wedding video. Check it out at PRI.org. News headlines are next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a Yemeni-American from the Bronx goes to Yemen for her wedding and is now stuck amid the bombing in the port city of Aden.
To be honest with you, I never thought I would say this, but we really don't know if we would wake up the next morning. I mean, that's how intense the situation is in terms of security.
Summer Nasser's story is just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There are many fronts in the global battle for gender parity. One of them is politics. Here in the U.S., we have never elected a woman president, but at least we've made some progress when it comes to electing women to a variety of other political offices. Our next story takes us to Turkey, where one political party has been trying a different method to achieve political gender parity. Today marks 1 year that some Turkish towns have been governed by pairs or co-mayors, one man and one woman. But it can still be difficult being a female politician in parts of Turkey. Here's reporter Dalia Mortada to explain how this program works.
Turkish voters elected almost 1,400 mayors to office a year ago. Of those, a grand total of 37 were women. the heavily Kurdish BDP added another 46 women to its roster as co-mayors, single-handedly more than doubling the number of female mayors in Turkey. These co-mayors are appointed, not elected. But this kind of political affirmative action is an important first step, says Zeynep Alemdar, co-founder of Women in Foreign Policy, an initiative dedicated to getting more women involved in policymaking in Turkey and abroad. Alemdar says it's basically impossible for women to be taken seriously as candidates here.
We are always required to have better education, better language skills. We have to be better at everything in order to be able to be nominated in politics. If you just look at the CVs of the female parliamentarians, and it's, you know, all online, they are all the women are much better educated than men.
Alemdar says that if that weren't enough, it often takes a powerful husband or father to get a woman a political nomination. And even then, they're usually restricted to making decisions in the domestic realm. Turkey's only female cabinet member is the Minister of Family and Social Policy. But a lot of these new co-mayors haven't followed the narrow path of women in Turkish politics. And that's what makes them so unique, Alemdar says. Take Mayor Berivan Elif Kilic. The 34-year-old was chosen as co-mayor of Kocaköy, a sleepy village of 17,000 people located on the climb up to the mountains in southeastern Turkey. As she talks on the phone in her mayoral office, which is decorated in plush purple couches, it's clear that Kilic has had a busy year. Kilic shares responsibilities with her elected co-mayor, who is also the village imam. That means he also has to conduct Friday prayers at the mosque and tend to people's religious needs. So sometimes Kilic is on her own. In the year since she became mayor, Kilic says, she spent less than a couple of weeks at home. She just got back from a month-long trip to Turkey's border with Syria, where the battle against ISIS rages on just a few hours' drive from Kocaköy. Kocaköy is one of the many villages that has taken in refugees from northern Syria and Iraq, so the mayor spends a lot of her time getting displaced Syrians and Iraqis what they need. Kilic has come a long way to reach a position of mayor. 5 years ago, with two kids in tow, she escaped an abusive marriage she entered when she was 15. The media, including international outlets, focus a lot on her backstory when she took office a year ago. But she's not interested in talking about the past. I am no victim. I'm strong, she declares. Now Mayor Kilic is completing her high school equivalency so she can go to university. And her goal for this five-year term is to start changing the way people think about women. A woman can't just do something for her own sake, Kilic says of traditional society here. She's always thought of in relation to someone else, as someone's mother or wife or daughter or girlfriend.
Berivan olarak kadın yaşam evi yapacağım, sabit semt pazar alanı yapacağım.
Kilic's goal is to set up programs that build women's confidence and self-reliance, like a local market where women sell their goods and products. After her term as mayor is up, I want other women to take over, she says. Zeynep Alemdar says Turkish politics needs more women like Kilic, a woman who refuses to accept the martyr persona that so often gets pinned on women in Turkish society, and a woman who wants to encourage others to take on positions of power.
I think that's a revolution. What she has gone through in her personal life doesn't matter. But she learned from that and actually went to a different tangent and decided to do something else and good for the community as well.
The hope, Alemdar says, is that the influence of women like Kilic will be seen in future elections to come. For The World, I'm Dalia Mortara in Kocaköy, Turkey.
We have a story now from Indiana, and it's not about that so-called freedom of religion bill that sparked so much controversy. Nope, this is an update on a story we told you about earlier this month. It's the one about Purvi Patel, a 33-year-old woman from South Bend, Indiana. We've been following her story as part of our project Across Women's Lives. A quick reminder, 2 years ago, Purvi Patel found herself pregnant. She got no prenatal care and showed up one night in a local emergency room. She was bleeding profusely. At first, didn't tell anyone she'd been pregnant. Soon after, though, she confessed she'd left the fetus in a dumpster. Beyond that, a lot is in dispute. Last month, a jury found Patel guilty of two charges, child neglect and feticide. And today, the judge in the case sentenced her to 30 years in prison, though she'll likely serve only 20. Reporter Amy Gastelum has been following the story for us. So first of all, Amy, explain, if you would, the sentence that Ms. Patel received?
She will likely serve those 20 years and then won't serve the additional 10 years unless she does something wrong while she's in prison or does something to violate her parole. She was also sentenced to 6 years for the feticide charge, but those 6 years will be served at the same time that she's serving the 20 years.
So it almost seems like these sentences were kind of being a little gentle on her.
Well, the thing is, she doesn't have any prior prosecutions. This is her first offense. So it's really common to give suspended years if it's a person's first offense.
So on the medical side of things and on just the gender side of things, what are the big concerns with this sentence?
Well, this is a big deal because it sets legal precedents in Indiana. So anytime somebody is charged or convicted in a new way, that case can be used to validate charges and convictions of someone in the future in the same way. So there's a lot of parties concerned here. Medical groups, certainly. Also reproductive rights groups, because this is new territory.
Yeah, and just what is so new about this?
Feticide in Indiana has never been used against a woman in this way, and that means any prosecutor who now wants to use feticide against a woman for outcomes of her own pregnancy can do that. One of the advocates who went to her sentencing today is an IU South Bend student, Andy Trowbridge, and she says that she went because she is concerned that women now will see this and they'll say, oh my gosh, I could be put in jail if something bad happens to my fetus. Maybe I won't go get prenatal care, or maybe I won't seek help during my pregnancy. And that's what these medical associations are also worried about.
Now, Purvi Patel apparently plans to appeal the sentence. What basis is she going to use?
Ms. Patel may have a few options for how she wants to appeal. Certainly, there have been medical experts who came out of the woodwork when the state's pathologist put her fetus's lungs in water to determine whether it had taken a breath. That is not something that is medically used anymore to determine life and breath. And the other thing is, when Purvi Patel was recovering from surgery, an officer came to interrogate her and didn't read her Miranda rights, didn't allow her family to see her, and her defense argued that that should have been considered an actual interrogation, in which case she would have had to been read her Miranda rights. She was not.
You know, Amy, this story of Purvi Patel did not seem to be connected to Indiana's freedom of religion bill when I first started talking to you a few minutes ago. But the judge in this case was appointed by Governor Mike Pence, who's behind the religious freedom bill. And this case tips into reproductive rights, hence religion. So I'm just wondering, what is the connection here? Is this a conservative issue?
I think this is definitely a conservative issue. There are some people who support this new bill that say that it does protect private businesses' rights to control their employees' reproductive rights. But also, yeah, I would like to point out that Judge Elizabeth Hurley, the judge in this case, was the very first Superior Court appointee by Mike Pence. And her role in this whole case is very significant. She got to control the kind of information that the jury was exposed to during the trial. And then she got to ultimately choose what the punishment would be for Purvi Patel. So she plays a huge role in this.
Reporter and registered nurse Amy Gastelum, thank you very much for the update.
Thank you.
Gaza, the tiny Palestinian territory on the shores of the Mediterranean. It's a corner of the world with huge problems. Tens of thousands of people there are still homeless after last year's war between Hamas and Israel, and nearly half the population of Gaza is unemployed. So you may be surprised to hear that someone launched a special mission there recently that would seem to have little practical meaning for average Gazans, rescuing a piano. Here's a story from our BBC colleague Tim Hewell in Gaza.
So this is the piano?
I don't know.
God, still covered in dust.
This is a string. They're all rouillé.
Yeah, they're all rusty.
Yeah, I have to change everything.
Oh, so this is pretty bad condition, really.
Yeah.
Claire Bertrand's a young French piano restorer, and she's just arrived in Gaza on a mission to bring a unique instrument back to life. In front of us is the territory's only concert grand piano, in the shell of a disused theatre, half destroyed by a rocket during last year's war with Israel. Against all the odds, it survived intact. But after years of neglect, it's virtually unplayable.
This is not a piano. Everything is dead.
To save the instrument, Claire will have to rebuild it from scratch.
How many strings is that you'll have to change?
Everything. 230 cordes.
230 strings to be changed?
Yes.
Wow.
That's the brutal sound of the strings being snapped. Then the whole instrument must be stripped of its innards. The hammers, the felts, everything will be replaced. Claire's mission has been organised by a Belgian charity called Music Fund and paid for by the conductor Daniel Barenboim, who gave a concert in Gaza 4 years ago.
Gaza is not only rockets and missiles and angry people and all that. I think the fact that the grand piano will be there and restored and playable would give the Gazans the possibility to have some kind of cultural activities. They need to hear really good music there.
This piano, actually, when I heard it, the story of it, I was astonished. Like they were talking about a real person. And I really looked forward to meeting this piano, actually.
Ayman Maramis is a rap artist who, like other musicians in Gaza, has been hoping the piano can be restored.
This piano will symbolize the struggle of the cultural life of Gaza. And now it's the rebirth of this piano. It's a struggle, so it's very symbolic.
It's important because playing any live music in Gaza has become increasingly difficult under the rule of the militant Islamist movement Hamas. Some people in the Strip even reject music as haram or religiously forbidden. Ayman can record his songs in a local studio, but he says he can't perform them in front of an audience.
Well, yeah, this is the thing. It's not just physical. It's not just the Israelis are attacking us culturally, economically or physically. It's also some conservative mentality in the community itself doesn't allow or forcing us from performing such concerts.
But the hope is that the reborn piano will help raise the status of music in Gaza. It's such a magnificent instrument, it almost demands to be heard. And this, after 10 days rebuilding, is the sound of Gaza's only concert grand, Silent No More. At the keys, the Strip's best young pianist, 15-year-old Sarah Ackle, performing to a small audience from Gaza's only music school. She's chosen Beethoven's 19th Sonata. She sees him as a survivor. And after living through three wars in the 6.5 years since she started learning the piano, she, like all the people of Gaza, is a survivor too.
Beethoven is just such a really deep person, and you can find that in his music. I mean, all those classical composers, you would see that they actually fought a lot and went through a lot. They survived it with music. So if they did that, then we can do that too.
Fifteen-year-old pianist Sarah Ackle ending that report by the BBC's Tim Ewell in Gaza. Be sure to stick around with us on The World coming up in just a minute, the story of Summer Nasser. She's a 20-year-old from the Bronx who's now stuck in Yemen as chaos consumes the country, and she's asking the Obama administration for help.
We would think because U.S. is supporting Saudi Arabia through logistics that they would tend to evacuate their citizens. We are calling upon the U.S. State Department to actually act and to evacuate the nationals. You know, there has to be some means of support for the U.S. citizens here.
More on that story in about 1 minute. You're listening to The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Yemen is a country on the brink of civil war, and as we reported last week, Saudi Arabia is conducting airstrikes against one faction in Yemen, the Houthis. Many civilians are now caught in the middle of the violence. It's so bad that some foreign governments have evacuated their citizens from Yemen, like Pakistan. Pictures from Karachi today showed Pakistanis just evacuated from Yemen as they reunited with their relatives back home. The U.S. government has flown out its employees, but it has not evacuated ordinary civilians. So Americans with loved ones still in Yemen, dual citizens mostly, must wait. I spoke earlier with Summer Nasser, a 20-year-old New York City native stuck in the port city of Aden. I asked her about an apparent Saudi airstrike that hit near her neighborhood today. Are you getting any warning that these airstrikes are coming? I mean, are there either air raid sirens or can you hear the jets arriving?
Unfortunately, we have no prior warning to any airstrikes or even potential airstrikes, which is concerning all of us for our safety.
Hmm. What is your own background, Summer? You're Yemeni with American citizenship?
I was born and raised in New York City, and okay. My parents, they've been there for 35 years in New York as well.
And how often do you go back to Yemen?
About twice a year, occasionally.
The U.S. advised Americans to get out of Yemen in February. I know you arrived on February 9th, but why did you stay?
My family is actually here, my mom and siblings. I wanted to make sure they're okay and to fly them out as soon as the school year ended for my siblings here.
How many Americans are in Yemen right now? Do you have a kind of a rough estimate?
I can roughly say we have in the thousands. I've been in contact with villages, the capital, Sana'a, and also Aden.
Do you have any sense of numbers in Aden?
In Aden, there are about a few hundred in Aden itself. I know that my neighbor, actually, who's in front of my house, he's actually from Michigan, Detroit. And I have a few other families in my area, my neighborhood. But, of course, there are people in the outskirts of Aden as well.
Are you staying in touch with them?
Yes, currently. I did try to keep in touch with them through social networks or phone calls. I've actually been asked from Yemeni Americans in the States to contact their family members in Aden where I can update them on any type of evacuation plans as well.
And how safe are you all feeling right now with these Saudi airstrikes?
We're not feeling so great. you know, coming from the States to this kind of situation, and to be honest with you, I never thought I would say this, but we really don't know if we would wake up the next morning. I mean, that's how intense the situation is in terms of security.
And is that lack of security that you're feeling, is that because you're worried about getting bombed yourself, or are you worried about the connection you have to the United States? And the Houthis are not real big fans of the Americans right now because the Americans are supporting the Saudi airstrikes.
Right. That's also, you kind of summed it up in essence. We're afraid of our security and our safety, number one, because we all, my family all have U.S. citizenships. And also we're afraid of the tanks shooting. It's an overwhelming situation. The bombs itself, the airstrikes. Also, you know, we're really worried. We really want to get out of here. We have a functional airport, but because of the no-fly zone implemented by the Saudi Arabian Kingdom, we're not allowed to fly out.
Yeah, so what message do you, Summer, have and the other American expats who are in Aden right now, for example? What message do you have for the U.S. State Department?
We were actually really disappointed that because Somalia and Pakistan and India have all evacuated their nationals, we would think because U.S. is supporting Saudi Arabia through logistics that they would tend to evacuate their citizens. We're trying our best to voice out our nervousness and disappointment through respectful means that we are calling upon the U.S. State Department to actually act and to evacuate the nationals, even through other countries, coordinate with them if they don't want to come near because of security reasons with Houthis, which is understandable. But, you know, there has to be some means of support for the U.S. citizens here.
Summer Nasser is an American from the Bronx. She is stuck in the Yemeni port city of Aden during the Saudi airstrikes. Summer, thank you very much, and please stay safe.
Thank you.
By the way, we contacted the U.S. State Department about this story. A spokesperson replied with a statement that said, quote, "There are no plans for a U.S. government-sponsored evacuation of U.S. citizens at this time. We encourage U.S. citizens to monitor the news and seek available departure options from Yemen via air, land, or sea," end quote. Still on the subject of getting to safety, we have an update on the incredible story that correspondent Marine Olivezi reported for us last Friday. It's about a Syrian activist named Kerem Al-Hamad. He'd been offered a fellowship at Syracuse University, but it wasn't clear he could make it to the U.S. because he could not get a passport. He was scheduled to fly out of Turkey on Friday, and that's where we left the story. So, without further ado...
Hello?
Hi, Kerem Al-Hamad.
Yeah.
Hi, Marco Werman here from PRI's The World. So, tell me where you are.
I'm now in Maxwell School in Syracuse University, New York.
Right.
I made it, finally.
Made it over. So you got on the plane, and then you fly to JFK in New York. What happened there?
Yeah. When I reached New York, I was sitting in a long line, waiting for my turn to get the visa stamped. Mm-hmm. And then a guy came and said, come with me, please. I went with him, told him, why did you choose me? He said, you're an important person. And guys were nice enough, so they started asking some questions about my travel, about the report that was published in the same day by Marine Olivezi on BRI.
Yeah, and apparently those officials had heard about the story on The World already, so they kind of knew who you were, right?
Yeah.
So while you were being questioned by these officials at the airport in New York, were you worried at all?
Yeah.
Were you feeling like maybe this is not going to work out?
Actually, after four times of being arrested by the Syrian regime, those things would not have been making me afraid. Mm. I just had to answer their questions. I understood that I'm Syrian, and they had to know some information.
So you're questioned for about an hour, and then they let you go. It's welcome to America,
yeah,
right?
They said sorry for making you late, and they took me to the terminal of my next flight to Syracuse from New York.
So you kind of hit the ground running. You're at Syracuse now. You're at the Maxwell School. You've already started classes. I mean, you're not wasting any time, are you?
This is my first day, yeah. And we had two lectures until now. It was great.
Is your stay here indefinite? Is it defined
by... No, I'm not staying. It's not an escape to the U.S. I'm here for Syria, and I'm going back to Turkey after I finish this fellowship.
Well, Kerem, welcome to the United States.
Thank you.
What can I say? Good news is good. That's Syrian activist Kerem Al-Hamad, now studying in Syracuse, New York. You can hear the original story at PRI.org. And that's our show today from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. The PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Tagney Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship at skoll.org, by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Ann Cerisi, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.